Committee on Healthcare Access of the House Committee on Healthcare to order, and tell you where we're going to go. We have three legislators here to testify on 2918 and lots of other people. So what I would like to do is to, I'll open up 2918, we'll hear from the legislators for introduction, then I'll close 2918 and open 2946 to hear what I think will be a relatively short set of presentations, and then reopen 2918 to make sure we have enough time for the testimony on that. Are people here on 163 as well?
Yes. I didn't bring up the sign.
Okay. It's going to be a long session. We'll see how we get. Do we have anybody coming in behind us?
I don't believe so today.
Senate subcommittee is coming in behind us in this room?
Here.
Yeah, no, but in this room. Okay, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2918 and call Representatives Buckley, Edwards, and Gelser to the. And if you folks want to come back, we'll send a staff to get you when we.
That'd be great.
When we start again.
Appreciate that very much. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Representative Peter Buckley, House District 5 from South Jackson County. We are bringing you a difficult bill. It comes to you on behalf of thousands of Oregonians who are in a difficult situation and asks you to make a difficult choice. On paper, what the bill proposes is straightforward. We're asking you to join a number of other states and the medical profession at large in changing the definition of pervasive developmental disorders, such as autism, from a mental disorder to what it really is, a neurological condition, a physical disorder. In making this change, the rules and standards for care for pervasive developmental disorders will change. Change is hard, and definite concerns will be raised. The word mandate will be raised over and over again, and you'll be hit by an issue that finds itself stuck in a very real way in a gray area. In last session, Senate Bill 1 on mental health parity, because you're being asked to deal with a condition requiring its own kind of comprehensive treatment. You will also, just so you know, be in the company of state legislators in 17 other states, including Indiana, California, Connecticut, Louisiana, Maine, Montana, New Hampshire, and Virginia, who had to face the same difficult choice that we're bringing you here today. They were able to face the difficult choice and hear past the impassioned short-term economic arguments to move their states to not only a far greater long-term, lower-cost financial picture for paying for the care of individuals with pervasive developmental disorders, but to a system of care that promises a far greater chance for independence and quality of life. The legislators in those states have worked through the difficult issues. We're asking you to engage with us and do the same for the benefit of our state. It's a difficult bill. Its difficulty is very much worth what we can gain from it. I'd just like to make three points that I hope you'll keep in mind throughout all the testimony from proponents with their very difficult stories of their children and their lives, and throughout the testimony from opponents as well. First, I hope you keep in mind that our beloved state of Oregon has the highest rate of autistic diagnosis within the United States, with one out of every 98 of our children on the autism spectrum. Second, I hope you'll keep in mind that we're not shying away from the economic realities of care for pervasive developmental disorders. For the simple fact, the bottom line dollar figures are on our side. The analysis done for the Virginia Assembly on this issue in 2006 revealed that comprehensive care for autism will increase policies for individual policyholders from 31 cents to $2 per month, and for group policyholders from 0 cents, anywhere from 0 cents to $2.94 per month. The same analysis done for the Virginia Assembly projects that once established, comprehensive care for pervasive developmental disorders would potentially decrease the cost of health care in their state, that every factor studied indicates a long-term gain. And third, I hope to keep in mind that studies have shown up to 50% of autistic children who received comprehensive early intervention care were classified as functioning independently after 3 years of treatment, and only 2% of autistic children in the same study who did not receive the same level of care reached that level of basic independence, 50% compared to 2%. It's a difficult choice, but it's a clear choice. I'm very grateful for your willingness to hear about this choice and to consider it. Representative Gelser and Representative Edwards can speak to you with far greater knowledge than I can, as can the other witnesses who will testify before you today. We also are joined by Dr. Lawrence Krupa from Portland to offer expert testimony on this issue. Again, I thank you for your time and your consideration of this bill.
Thank you, Representative. We have one of those rare chances to harass our colleagues. Are there any?
And we invite it.
You have to watch out. If you have an education bill, you don't want to do it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chris Edwards. I'm representative from District 14 in West Eugene, Santa Clara, and Junction City. And I come to you with a personal vested interest in this issue, as my five-year-old son, Simon, is one of the 1 in 98 Oregonian children who has been diagnosed with autism. This is a picture of my son, and from looking at him, you would never know that or guess that he has a developmental disorder such as autism. And so I will. I also want to enter onto the record testimony from a constituent of mine from the Gass-Gilchrist family in Junction City, Oregon, Angie Gass-Gilchrist and George Gilchrist, who want some testimony entered on behalf of their family, and they have a three-year-old daughter with autism as well. And I will preface my comments by stating that I am not an expert on the issue. I am trying to become an expert as much as I can, but I will simply be giving you the perspective of a parent that has dealt with the issue and a policymaker. To set the stage a bit, autism is a spectrum disorder. It is, and so kids that have autism, and I'm going to speak mostly about kids because that's where my experience lies. Some kids have very severe cases, and some kids would be, for lack of a better term, mild. The issues that we face with my son are specifically in the areas of speech, articulation and intelligibility of his speech, vocabulary, sentence structure. He's five, and as a point of reference, he speaks as if he's three. Social interactions are tough. Doesn't play particularly well with other kids. Plays parallel with other kids, among other kids, but not really with them so much. Transitions are difficult for him. Routine is paramount in our family, and any change to that routine really throws his whole mental state into it's difficult for him, and it takes a while to kind of recover. And from a personal habit standpoint, training him to be able to swish his mouth out and spit while he brushes his teeth. I mean, we're still working on that, and we don't have it down yet. Just little challenges like that. His diet, he's very narrow-minded when it comes to what he eats. There are certain foods that he does eat. They're mostly bland and white in color. And there are certain foods that he does not eat. Anything that is orange or green certainly does not fall into that category, which provides some nutritional challenges. I don't suspect that many of you noticed that when we were on the first day of session, during all the ceremonies and whatnot, most folks had their families there with them by their side, and folks sitting at their desk. And I was sitting there by myself, and my wife and my son were over behind the sidebar because, just confining him to that type of a space with that many people around is just undoable. And we make those adjustments, and everybody has challenges raising their kids and that are unique to their situations and unique to their children. And I'm certainly not claiming that claiming that other people don't have their own challenges. But I am claiming, though, that the challenges that we have with Simon are rooted in in the condition of autism. And I'm also claiming that proactive treatment and therapies do make a difference in the eventual outcomes for these kids. And I'm here to argue that actually those are, if we figure out a better way to address this issue, we are going to be the net beneficiaries financially. I mean, not just morally, but financially from proactive intervention. I have submitted as part of my testimony a series of questions because I wasn't really, you know, as I composed my testimony, I thought, there's a lot of different ways to address it, but I figured I would just pose a series of questions and some answers. And starting out with, you know, what is autism spectrum disorder? Because I think a lot of us have certain notions that originate from TV movies about what people with autism might be like and how they might behave. And it's essentially a qualitative impairment in social interaction, a qualitative impairment in communication, and restrictive, repetitive, and stereotype patterns of behavior, interest, and activities. The diagnosis process that we went through, at least with my son, and it's probably different in different parts of the state, but in Eugene, there were two different tracks when we started suspecting that there was something going on with Simon. There were two different tracks that we could take for diagnosis. Our pediatrician recommended that we get on the waiting list at the Child Development and Rehabilitation Center, CDRC, at the University of Oregon. That waiting list is 6 months. We got on it 6 months later, approximately 6 to 9 months, somewhere in there. We went in for a comprehensive battery of tests with a number of different specialists and professionals.
Chris, that was University of Oregon?
Yes, at the University of Oregon. Mm-hmm. Correct. I don't know who those folks are that test people in other areas of the state. I'm just speaking from my own experience in Eugene. And I also invite future people that are going to be testifying after me to correct anything that's factually incorrect that I mentioned, because I'm going off my memory of what we did a couple of years ago. That diagnosis, we were able to take that diagnosis and use it, present it to the Education Service District, Laney SD, to qualify him for early childhood intervention services. Now, alternatively, it's my understanding that's a medical diagnosis. Alternatively, one can get an educational diagnosis through the ESDs. And the irony of all of this is that if one doesn't undergo the medical diagnosis and just goes with the educational diagnosis, that diagnosis will not become a part of that child's medical record. And if it's not a part of the medical record, then you could actually have prescribed speech therapy, occupational therapy, that insurance would cover. And so, I mean, there's a little bit of irony to that, and I just wanted to point that out. Indeed, there are a number of treatments for autism, which I've listed there, including applied behavioral analysis, medications, occupational therapy, pivotal response time, physical therapy, speech and language therapy, and others. There are going to be, I mean, there are inevitable societal costs of this escalation in autism. 20 years ago, I can't remember what exactly the numbers were, but something like 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 1,200. There's been a lot of speculation about why we've had this escalation in the diagnosis of autism. Some folks speculate that it's just we're simply diagnosing better, and we've always had that those type of numbers. My own thoughts about that in the study and stuff that I've listened to is that that may be a part of it. I doubt that that's really driving the escalation in numbers. And there are a lot of other theories, and I'm not here to say, to try to speculate what scientists can't agree on, you know, what's causing this escalation. But the escalation is an issue. I mean, 1 in 98 kids, I mean, that is driving special education costs in this state. And I can't imagine that it's not someday down the road, as we see this bubble move through the system, that it's not also going to put increased strains on the criminal justice system. I mean, we have a condition that affects kids socially and from a social interaction standpoint. It affects their ability to learn and actually acquire these skills and knowledge and abilities that they need to be independent, productive citizens. And I just can't imagine that that's not going to have some sort of effect in the cost of the criminal justice system in the future as this big, big bubble moves up through the system, through adolescence and into early adulthood. We know that there are higher rates of divorce among parents of children with autism. And of course, there is, if the condition goes untreated, there's the inevitable loss in adult economic productivity and an increased reliance on social welfare programs. So I'm arguing that that we should be morally compelled to use the insurance mechanism to pay for autism treatment. It's a condition that we know if we treat, we get better outcomes, and we are, in fact, already experiencing the increased costs to society, and I think that those costs show no sign of letting up if we don't start getting proactive about treatment options. And those treatment options are very expensive for the individual family to bear. I mean, you talk about occupational therapists, speech and language therapists, and a number of other specialists who can really provide services that'll advance the development, the neurological and mental development and skill sets of those kids. But that's a lot of appointments to keep in a week's time. And try holding down a job and doing that. And I think while many of us would say, well, the ideal family situation would be where there's one parent available at all times to stay at home and watch the kids, I don't think that the marital and economic realities are such in this state. And so it's not just the big bills that are accrued at the specialist office. It's also it's being committed to that child, and doing what's right for that child takes that parent out of the workforce. If we don't pass, if we do not pass 2918, the status quo will remain, which largely treats autism as an educational issue. But that will continue to ignore legitimate medical interventions, which can really further the development of these kids. And I fear that we have an insurance mechanism that has been, for better or worse, insurance is how we pay for medical care in the United States. And if that's going to be the mechanism, then I think it's legitimate that mechanism covers conditions like autism. The the lack of, because we have those are not coupled. The insurance mechanism, which pays for medical in our state, and the educational system, which is funded through public dollars, there isn't a coupling of those. Yet ignorance of the medical side of the issue is actually a cost driver in our educational system. And so it's costing us, I believe, it's costing us more, and we're getting lower outcomes from it. So I'm challenging the committee to try to think holistically about the issue. I'm very interested and willing to have very frank discussions with the committee, either here or at another time. I don't want you to feel like you have to tiptoe around the issue because my son has autism. You cannot offend me. I think we need more frank discussions about issues regarding mental health. And I think a lot of us, especially as legislators, don't want to say the wrong thing, so we kind of tiptoe around it, and it's hard to get to the meat of the issue. So I invite that, and I'd be happy to talk with you or answer any further questions. And I do need to go to another committee to testify, and I'll be back later. So thank you for the opportunity.
Any questions? I would like to ask you one question.
Yeah.
For 2 months now you've had, I don't know what your health insurance situation was before January, but for the last 2 months you've had about as deluxe a health insurance package, I suspect, is available. Do you think your current health insurance package will be covering the medical needs of your child?
I don't believe so.
A good test.
Mm-hmm. It would be a good test.
And I won't tiptoe around. I have a granddaughter with Asperger's, so it's a topic I'm very familiar with personally and professionally. Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. Representative Edwards, I was just wondering if you had any figures or any of your colleagues there. You talk about the difficulty of raising a child with autism as a two-parent family. As a single mom, and I've dealt with numerous single moms in the schools and dads that try to do this alone, do you have any figures of how many people are trying to do this by themselves?
Chair Greenlee, Representative Comp, I don't have those figures. My wife, Allie, and I talk frequently about how we don't know how anybody can do this on their own.
I've seen parents do it, but it's very, very, very almost impossible.
Yeah.
Challenging. The challenges are incredible.
Representative Gelzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state representative from House District 16, which is Corvallis and Philomath, and two people that live in Linn County, outside of the city limits of both of those towns. I am here today also as a parent to tell a personal story and to commend Representative Buckley and his co-sponsors for raising a question that points to a whole host of issues. I am also the parent of a child with special needs, but my child does not have autism. He has a syndrome with a very glamorous name. It's called FG syndrome. We were quite disappointed to not get something a little bit more snazzy after a couple of years of looking for the name of what his genetic syndrome was. Like children with autism, Sam does not have access to the same kinds of medical coverage that children without disabilities don't have. And I can answer the question that was asked earlier in terms of the medical plan that we currently have. It does not cover many of the medical needs that he has. It didn't when I worked for DHS, and it didn't when we had Regents Blue Cross through my husband's employer either. And this is, it covers his major medical costs. He had his first neurosurgery when he was 3.5 weeks old, his second second one just after his first birthday, his first spinal cord surgery when he was five, and a host of other what we like to call adventures in between. And between those many adventures, we had the day-to-day care and support of his growth and well-being. And part of that are the auxiliary kinds of services that help children to become more independent and more successful. Those would include things like speech therapy, occupational therapy, and physical therapy. When he was little, he received early intervention, early childhood special education services, for which we were quite grateful, but he needed more, and as parents, it was our responsibility to go out into the market and get that. We were very frustrated when we would try to get that covered by our insurance to be told that that was an educational need and that that should be covered by the school system. When we asked the school system for the types of services that he needed, the school system would tell us those were medical needs and those should be covered by insurance and in the private market. Fortunately for Sam, we have the financial ability to purchase some of these services for him. We have to choose which ones, because if you can imagine $120 a week for each service, it would be hard to do speech therapy, physical therapy, and occupational therapy all at the same time. Because Sam was not able to speak very many words, I think he was first able to say mom when he was about 4.5 years old. It was a wonderful day. And now he talks a lot. A whole lot, and I promise to never complain about that. We kind of put aside the physical therapy and the occupational therapy because we felt like his independence depended most on his ability to speak and be understood. However, when he was about 5 or 6 years old, we had the first experience that really irked me and frustrated me. He was seeing a provider for speech therapy, and I had a daughter who suddenly needed speech therapy. The diagnosis and treatment code for the service that she needed was the same as the service that she needed for Sam. Same provider, same diagnosis code, same parents. Same insurance company. It was approved for my daughter and denied for my son because he had a developmental delay or a developmental disability. A couple of years later, we had a daughter that needed a little bit of occupational therapy, and we went through the same thing. Same provider, same insurance company, same parents, same diagnosis code. Ellie could get the service, and Sam could not because he had a developmental delay. This was very frustrating to me that if our insurance company did not know that he was a person with a developmental delay or a developmental disability, he could have received the services. The place where I think that this makes a difference is as he's getting older. He's 12 now, which means we're two-thirds of the way through this journey and starting to think about what's going to happen when he goes out into the world on his own. The ability to be able to use your hands for self-care is pretty important. I still brush his teeth for him every night when I'm home. When I'm not, I assume my husband is doing that. He needs assistance with personal things in the bathroom. It's become apparent to me that shaving is in our future, and we're going to have to figure out how to help him with that. At school, there are many things he can't participate in because it's hard for him to hold and use a pencil. When I got that email in my eval box about the TESA system being down and the tests being done by paper and pencil, and he's required to take them even though he can't answer the questions because he has a developmental disability and he's not excluded by NCLB, which is another issue altogether, without those fine motor skills, he's not able to participate in that test. That becomes another barrier for him. Self-dressing, putting coins in a box on a bus, and certainly the employment opportunities that are going to be available to him. So this is a medical service and a medical need that we have a very difficult time accessing for him. He's been able to access it more because we have the finances to do that. Many families do not. So what I commend Representative Buckley for is raising this issue of inequity, and whether it's the insurance system or the school system or something that we haven't yet thought of, we have children and people with disabilities that have services that they need to access, and families, the services exist, and I kind of picture sometimes my son standing on this ladder trying to get something that's just out of reach that he really needs. Whether this is the vehicle and it's expanded to include not just kids with autism, but also kids like my son or kids with cerebral palsy, or there's another way to get to getting these necessary services to these kids, it's a problem that I hope that we can incorporate into this overall question about healthcare reform and really keeping in mind the needs of this population as well in adulthood, who really do have a very specialized set of needs that are very legitimate, that contribute to their quality of life and their ability to be productive workers and family members, friends, and neighbors. So thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Representative Gelser. Okay, well, Will, thank you very much. I see this is going to be a very interesting hearing.
Mr. Chair, can I just, Representative Comp had asked about, and I was handing a note from the Representative Edwards before he left, and I'll get the report to back this up, but apparently there's an 80% plus divorce rate for families with autistic children, and currently there are 6,274 autistic children in Oregon schools.
Diagnosed autistic children.
Thank you very much for your time and attention.
Thank you very much. I will temporarily close the hearing on House Bill 2918 and open the hearing on House Bill 2946 and invite Representative Maurer. You want to start? You want Representative Kohler to join you? Dr. Kohler? Dr. Kohler, you haven't want to comment on what CDRC does. In this area?
Well, CDRC, the University of Oregon, there is a branch in Eugene of the CDRC, OHSU. There's a statewide network, actually.
Representative Maurer?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am honored to sit here today and talk about one of the few bills that are presented this session that deal with healthcare reform in a way that is not talking about finances. When we look into the issue of healthcare reform, we are focused on, and in many ways appropriately focused on, finance. Finance is a driver with how delivery is provided or how healthcare services are delivered in this country. But it is clear that we must also address healthcare delivery. My background in primary care and my experience in 20 years in the military in primary care in different settings leads me to believe that we need to think outside the box. We need to look at different ways, given limited resources and given the need to address a system that we all can agree needs to be fixed. And so I am the proud sponsor of House Bill 2946. Dr. Kohler, former president of OHSU, was gracious enough to offer his plan, and I was excited to hear about it, and there's more to be heard, and that's about all I have to say, because this is really Dr. Kohler's show, and I stand behind him all the way, but we have got to look at ourselves in the issue of healthcare reform and not focus solely on finance, but let's look at the dual path of healthcare delivery reform. Thank you.
Thank you.
If I could just ask
Absolutely.
A question. Dr. Kohler and I were talking earlier. Do you have any idea whether there's going to be a fiscal attached to this? Is that a subsequent referral to Ways and Means?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
My belief is that if there is, it's a minimal fiscal, and the department, I believe, will address that today. And I believe that they're supportive of the bill. As it's written, there will be several amendments that will be offered. But as far as a fiscal, I believe it is minimal.
Good. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
I'm going to move next door where I can reach the pad. Chairman Greenlick, members of the committee, I really am pleased to be here today. Thank you for inviting us and to Representative Maurer for introducing this bill. I am going...
Right, you have to state a conflict of interest after 10 years of you harassing me as my boss. Now I get a shot back.
Yeah, you have a real chance. This is your opportunity. This is going to be a brief presentation by me on the situation in healthcare, and you're going to have a demonstration by Dr. Steve Datna, who is part of LifeCom, on the system that we would anticipate using. But I thought we should start out, today happens to be Einstein's birthday, with a quote from Einstein. I did not realize that he was this eloquent, but we are, in fact, in healthcare continuing to do the same thing over and over, even though we are running into a lot of difficulty with accommodating the burgeoning need. The program to be described today we have called CHAMP. We called it lots of other things earlier, but we had gone up to see the head of CMS in Seattle, and he said, can't you come up with a better name than what we were using? So we tortured the words into
CMS,
CHAMP.
Dr. Kohler, we try and spell these out.
Did I say
CMS?
Yes. It's
Center for Medicaid and Medicaid.
Services. Yes. Thank you. The Computer Health Access Medical Practice is the thing that CHAMP stands for. And what this will allow us to do, should it be able to be tested, is to use really teams of providers and expanding the role of every member of that team. And we will use technology in a way that has really not been used, I think, as effectively as it can and will be in the future to help take care of people in primary care. The factors driving the need for change, the practitioner shortage, and as you know, OHSU is trying to address this right now. We need more of literally every member of the healthcare team. That includes certainly nurses to start with, but physicians as well, pharmacists, literally everybody. The aging population, particularly the boomer population, as you know, and the growing number of uninsured are all problems that need to be addressed. I've talked recently to a number of primary care physicians. They are working at maximal speed. Many of them are scheduling a new patient or a patient every 7 minutes. This has led to what's called the doorknob visit, where the doctor never lets go of the doorknob and tries to give the impression to the patient that they're spending a sufficient amount of time with them. As you can imagine, that's quite a challenge and not very satisfactory, by the way, to the physician or to the patient or anybody else. This is the demographic picture that we're confronting. Take a look at the population there, and we are almost at the deflection point where the boomers will begin to be over age 65. Notice that the maroon color down below, if you can see that, is the above 85 population. And if you look at the need for health care, it definitely increases dramatically as you grow older. In our hospital, we have some numbers. People who are above age 65 need to be hospitalized about three times the rate of a younger adult. Those above 85 need to be hospitalized at about five times the rate of a younger adult. So as the population ages, which is a good thing, it is going to require more and more health care to be delivered to these individuals. What we are proposing to do is to test a combination of a team approach, which has been used in many instances already, but really with IT, which you'll see in just a minute. And I think that has the potential
IT, that's cool.
Information technology, excuse me. This has the potential to do several things, all of which are going to be needed. Reduce our costs. Enhance the quality. I think the interaction will be much more satisfactory to both the patient and to the healthcare provider team member. The customer service should be better. We will be able to use decision support software, and frankly, a lot of other things can be programmed in that will be important, such as prevention, scheduling, and that sort of thing that I think will really allow us to be much more customer friendly. We want to compare this to the standard practice, so we want to just not jump in, as so often is the case in healthcare, with something new without testing it against what we're doing currently. That is our goal, and we are also working to try to decide what is the optimal composition of the team. We anticipate four levels: a medical assistant, a nurse practitioner or a physician's assistant, and a physician as the members of the team. When care becomes too complex, obviously they would be referred to a specialist beyond the primary care aspect of the team being studied. However, the medical assistant will be the front line in this particular study. We have some initial data. We've tested this out at the Richmond Clinic, actually at Outside In, with a medical assistant from the Richmond Clinic, and find the medical assistant to be doing an excellent job in entering the information and getting to the situation. And Dr. Datner will describe that more to you in his presentation. But the medical assistant will be backed up. This is not in any way trying to lower the level of the care provided to the individual by a full gamut of the nurses, nurse practitioners, and other members of the team. We think this will allow a more efficient use of time and expertise so that the physician, for example, or even the nurse practitioner would really only need the patients who require an additional level of expertise beyond that that can be provided by the front level or the nurse. Every provider will be working within their scope of practice, and this is another slide which sort of shows what we have now. We have an overload situation for many physicians and nurse practitioners. I would say that's probably true for many nurses as well in primary care. And we have medical assistants who are working below their scope of training. This is the level of health care, and we're using the term re-engineered. Working with some engineers, by the way, has been very interesting, and that's what we're doing here. We're looking at re-engineering health care. You can see the level of education being provided at the different tiers of practitioner. There is a scope of practice for each of these, and we are anticipating that all of these team members will operate within their current scope of practice. We're not pushing the envelope one way or another beyond what they're currently trained to do. But we will be able to have access to training programs so that medical assistants can be trained to operate the system. I've been asked before, why don't we just do this with nurses? The simple answer is there are just not enough nurses. There is a shortage of nurses, which is perhaps more acute in nursing than in most of the other areas of healthcare. But nurses are clearly integral to the success of the team approach. The thing that makes this possible, and we've been talking about doing this for several years, is the support software. And I was very pleased. Actually, Dr. Datner and I have had discussions over the last maybe 6 years or so about using this kind of software to triage patients in emergency rooms to the level of care that's necessary. What we're trying to do here is use the same software adapted to this purpose for primary care. So we think it can be a seamless, coordinated system. Prevention will be built in. Scheduling, as I mentioned, can all be part of that. The pilot project at Outside In will be commented on briefly by Dr. Datner. We are now looking to do a second pilot using multiple sites. This actually came out of a discussion that we had earlier. Rather than a single large pilot, trying to get people comfortable with this system. And one of the things that we think is important to test is the point at which they should be handed off from one team member to another. We ultimately would like to be able to have a large number of patients compared, and we think that the Medicaid program provides a very logical type of individual, because there's so much difficulty having access to adequate care, to incorporate in such a study. And again, our bias going in is that care can be provided through this team concept in a way that is frankly going to turn out to be better than what they currently have right now. This is partly because people have so much difficulty getting scheduled to be seen. And we would like to be able to start this by July of 2007. I think that is probably not realistic in the present time. But I think to close again with another Einstein statement, we've got to change the way we approach this. We're not going to be able to solve problems using the same kind of thinking that we used when we created them. We didn't do this on purpose. It has just grown. The need has grown disproportionately. And I think it is going to be important to try to recognize as early as we can that the current vehicle that we use for healthcare practice just is not going to be able to accommodate the larger, enlarging population, aging population we're going to see. With that, I would like to introduce Dr. Datna and ask him to give a demonstration.
You stay in at the...
Yes. We're also going to hear, hopefully, from Jim Edge, from DMAP, on this project.
And Senator Hayden as well.
Behind.
Yeah. Senator Hayden is happy to... Well, we're happy to have him support us. He is not part of our presentation.
No, I think he's asked to testify.
Sitting up, can you ask questions?
Well, we'll see. Anyway.
He is here, and we've talked.
His name is on a list in front of me.
Oh, okay.
Thank you, Dr. Culler.
Well, no, I'm happy to take questions now.
Will you be dealing with...
Does that work for you, okay? Questions now?
I'd be happy to answer one or two now. I want to be sure we have time for the demonstration, but certainly.
Senator Richardson.
Dr. Culler, I'm wondering if, as you've discussed this, and whether the model will deal with two things. One is the financial incentives that would enable physicians to want to make a transition, and the second is what provisions will deal with the escalating, inflating costs of health care to help curb those costs so that whatever we do will be able to be sustained 3 years from now.
Right. Well, if we go back, we're imagining that this front end of this will have to, should be probably capitated. And what this should allow physicians to want to do is to enlarge the panel of patients they have. Maybe from the current average is about 2,300. I'm guessing 5,000 or maybe even more could be accommodated by a team so that everybody within the team can benefit from that. The question about the escalating other parts of healthcare costs, this system that you're about to see will capture a great deal of information. So I think that referrals for special care, specialty care, will be much more carefully evaluated in this system than sometimes they are right now. So I think that the referral system will be improved as a result of the data captured by the LifeCom system.
Okay. Dr. Gasser, how long are you thinking for this demonstration?
Less than 10 minutes.
Go for it.
I'm fine. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Steve Datna. I'm a trauma surgeon and the founder of LifeCom. As Dr. Kohler had mentioned, I've been working with him for a number of years on trying to develop this methodology, and I will address a couple of the questions that have already come up. This software is what we're currently using for the medical assistants, and they're entering data. So I'm just going to go ahead and do a very quick demo that would be similar to how the medical assistant would take a history. And basically what we're using is we're using the medical assistants to take a detailed history. And so going down, for example, here, we'll go to history of present illness under HPI, and we'd be able to do, basically be able to describe the signs and symptoms that a patient might come in with. And one of the advantages of doing this with medical assistants is they are going to have time. And in our initial pilot projects, we've been able to demonstrate that they have time to take very detailed histories. Detailed histories and good physical exams are one of the ways to get away from having to have as much emphasis on more expensive technologies, for example. A lot of very good data collecting can oftentimes, number one, as Dr. Kohler was saying, help us direct patients to the appropriate practitioner level, but also maybe avoid unnecessary testing and assessments, as well as the utilization of best practices protocols to take care of some of these patients. So the medical assistant would basically be interviewing the patient and using a combination of graphic interfaces like we're talking about on this tablet PC. For example, this patient would have a new headache. It's only on one side of their head. It's a fixed point headache, and it's sort of around their eye. It's basically developed rapidly. It is occurring right now. It's been going on for about 2 hours. And as we go through, we can actually add additional information. Now, as the medical assistant enters data into the system, for example, going back here, there's a built-in artificial intelligence system in the software that is guiding the medical assistant in asking the questions that they need to collect for the rest of the care providers. Medical assistants are not trained to know all these complicated, nuanced questions, but the artificial intelligence can direct them to ask questions. And on this side of the screen, you see over here, are a differential diagnosis that the artificial intelligence is looking at, which is quite extensive. And below here are questions that the artificial intelligence system will be developing and actually presenting as more data comes in to direct the medical assistants to ask the questions that are necessary to get a good, detailed assessment of this patient. It may ask for additional labs. It may request some type of examination findings as it's going along. We can answer these questions. Some of the refinement questions or either down through here, or we can go up to a particular diagnosis. For example, here's a little worrisome contender in the differential, and we can go and say, okay, here's a couple of quick questions that if you answer this, you're going to know one way or another whether we need to worry about this. Yes, this patient's had this headache before, and it switches sides. And basically, as the data goes in, the artificial intelligence will continue to change how it responds, as well as the types of questions that it asks. Now, in addition to that, going down here at the bottom, it asks a lot of questions, and it asks them in a way that doesn't bias the person. It doesn't tell them what it's looking for, and it doesn't tell them whether it's a positive piece of information or negative. But it can ask down, for example, these questions in the gray area. It can basically ask questions that don't pertain to this differential. So this is one of the ways to assist the physicians, is the patient may come in with a chief complaint and say, I have a headache. But in point of fact, maybe it's an eye problem, for example. So what the artificial intelligence will look for is other problems that might be masked by what the patient is saying. So, for example, here it comes in and says, asks a demographic question, says, is this an African-American patient? We can send that back and answer it. And now, basically, the differential diagnosis changes. We're collecting our notation here and recording all the information that's been recorded. And you'll see up here that it's now considering a different consideration that's related to a vision problem as opposed to a headache problem. We can ask it why it's considering these things, and the artificial intelligence will tell us exactly why it's making the considerations and recommendations, so those physicians will be able to follow on and make sure that they concur with that kind of information. You also notice, although one piece of information changed the differential, it was looking at a lot of things in the potential for this diagnosis before it made that assessment. This next part up here is key to the project, is the medical assistants, as we said before, are not necessarily trained to recognize subtle or critical patterns. The artificial intelligence is designed to do that for them. So because this potentially dangerous situation is developing, the artificial intelligence has instructed the medical assistant to terminate their part of this assessment and take this patient to the doctor. So a lot of the safety for being able to identify those patients who need the skills of some other level of practitioner is actually built into the software itself. And again, it will tell us why that is. It's because, well, it's concerned about glaucoma, and this is potentially a loss of sight situation. So obviously the interface has lots of other places where we can put in a lot of other kinds of data, but I think in essence this gives us the broad approach to how this would work in practice. In the outside-in project that Dr. Kohler was talking about, the initial results have been very good. We've done. We're now looking at the first 100 patients. We looked at the first 30 patients. We've already done complete assessment of those cases. The results have been excellent. Medical assistant has been able to collect a very good and very comprehensive set of data on the patients. The differential diagnosis that the diagnostic engine has created has been very related to what the physicians who saw the patient, so there's been very good correlation between what the artificial intelligence was thinking versus what the physicians were thinking, and patient satisfaction thus far has been excellent. They've responded very well to this because they have an opportunity to spend a lot of time with somebody telling them their problem. So I'll stop there.
Thank you. Questions?
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And thank you for the presentation. One of my frustrations as a patient has been going to the doctor's office, filling out a form that gives some of my medical history and perhaps what I'm experiencing, then going and telling the same thing to a nurse, and then the doctor comes in and hasn't looked at any of that and is asking me all the same questions for a third time. Obviously, this is a more sophisticated way of getting that data and probably a more targeted way. What about this model of service delivery can assure me or at least suggest that a doctor, the physician who ultimately sees me, is going to have the time to spend with the information in order to make a accurate and valuable diagnosis?
Do you want to take that?
Yeah, I got it. That's a great question. In fact, it's been one of the things that we've worked very, very hard on. I think obviously, there's lots of aspects of the system that we haven't touched on. One of the critical parts that you relate is this system actually collects and records your entire patient history. So when a patient goes in, their entire medical records actually will be loaded into this system. So one aspect of that is hopefully you won't have to answer those questions ever again. The artificial intelligence never forgets. So once that information is into the system, all of that information that you put in will be used in every assessment that it makes. So if there's information pertaining to 10 years ago that is useful, the artificial intelligence will pull that out and make that available to the physician to look at. Part of what we're doing here, and again, to give the physicians time, it's a lot like the heads-up display in airplanes. One of the things the system does is present the information in a very concentrated fashion so that hopefully we can be sure that the right questions have been asked, comprehensive exam and evaluation has been done, and then actionable set of information is presented to the doctor so that a lot of that sort of redundant process can be eliminated.
Can I add to that just one second?
Are we done with the demonstration?
Oh, sure.
Can you put the lights up, please?
Yeah, a couple things. One, there are a number of conditions for which people go to physicians that they don't actually need to see the physician. So there are going to be some milder, more benign conditions where the nurse practitioner or the physician's assistant will be able to take care of it. Those that are more complex, the physician ought to actually be able to spend more time than the 7 minutes that are currently allocated, helping to sort out the more complex problems. So the idea is the physician is going to have to work harder and longer on the most complicated problems, whereas the simpler things can be taken care of by other members of the team. This, by the way, means that you would not see a physician every time you go to see the team. And that is part of what has to be learned, I think, by the clientele involved in this study.
We're in a lot of places now, right?
That's all right. A lot of places are like that right now. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I mean, I think just as a sort of follow-up comment, the issue, to my mind, one of the main issues has not been the data collection that takes place in a medical office. Quite a bit of that goes on. There's a good record of my medical history. It's been how that data is actually used and accessed by the nurses, by the physicians. It's been the fact that, boy, the information's in there somewhere, but it takes so long to find it that they'll just ask me again or they won't at all. And so I think, you know, as we consider reform and look at projects like this, we should be thinking very carefully, not just about making sure that data gets into the file or into the electronic record, but that it's usable and that physicians and nurses and physicians' assistants have time to use the data that they've collected.
Right. And one of the beauties of this system and one of the things that has really intrigued me, as more data gets entered, the differential diagnosis of what it is that you're evaluating shifts so that the best way to organize the information that you have is going to be captured by this particular system. Or we're going to find out that it doesn't capture it. We think it will. So I think that when you go to whoever the next level is, they're going to have a listing of most probable difficulties that the patient is encountering and be able to focus on the most likely. And the rest of the data will also be captured in there, including some things that won't show up that are such far outliers. They're still captured in the system.
Right. And that is a primary goal of this project, is what you've described, which is if we're going to collect data, it all has to be dynamically used and available at the time of decision making.
I have a question. It may seem like an odd question. Why are you here?
By that I mean
retirement.
No. By that I mean
I have an answer.
Would produce for you.
Yes, we have been knowing that there were several pieces of this that need to be sorted through. The specific reason that we're here, and maybe actually Mr. Edge would be a better person to answer this. We need to get statutory approval to approach CMS for a waiver. And that's the specific thing that we seem to need. I will defer to him.
Greg, you going to join us? Sign in, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlake and members of the committee. I'm Jim Edge. I'm the interim administrator of the Division of Medical Assistance Programs in the Department of Human Services.
Congratulations.
Thank you, I think. My comments can be very short. I just want to say that the department is fully supportive of new and better technologies in provision of medical care, and we're fully supportive of efforts to promote efficiencies, and we support this project. My understanding is that the project would like to use the Medicaid program, the Oregon Health Plan, to conduct its next pilot project. And that's not mentioned in the bill at the present time. So I would suggest that the bill probably needs an amendment to mention that and to direct us, the Department of Human Services, to pursue waiver amendment approval with the federal government, with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. If you direct us to do that, we will do that, and we're supportive of the bill with that change.
And maybe some matching funds if there's where you get some funds to match.
Chair Greenlake, there certainly would be matching funds for the clients who are Medicaid clients who are part of the pilot project. In answer to your earlier question about a fiscal, we're not anticipating a fiscal on this. It's our understanding that the project would be getting funds elsewhere for the software and the hardware and the individuals who would be entering the information into these computers. Our part would be to get the approvals from the federal government, and we're not anticipating there would be a fiscal for the department.
Will you help get the language that you need?
Mr. Chair, certainly, yes.
And it's possible if it turns out there you really tell legislative fiscal there's no fiscal, that we could avoid the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. So we'll explore that with you if you would be so kind as to do so.
Certainly.
Anything else you have in mind? Oh, yeah.
Chair Greenlake, I have a question about your connection between the requirements we need for the state and the feds. As somebody that hasn't quite finished their dissertation, I always think about the things that you need to do to ensure privacy rights, and when I'm curious about, this is not called a research pilot, but in an essence, in the heart of it, feels like it is. So is there going to be any kinks in that continuum to make sure that a patient's rights are, you know, upheld? And
Chair Greenlake and Representative Comp, yes. My understanding at this point is that one of our managed care organizations, Care Oregon, is interested in working with the project, and the project might actually be done within the patients of that managed care organizations. And certainly that would be something we would be concerned about, and the federal government would be concerned about, is the privacy issues and making sure that patient rights are a high concern in that.
Right.
And maybe you'd like to address that.
Why don't you describe how we are currently protecting the anonymity?
And it doesn't have to be a long explanation.
Sure. One thing that absolutely would be true is that this additional project would be done under an institutional review board evaluation.
That
so
does.
The initial pilot, does that answer?
Yes, that takes care of it.
Might need individual consent forms. Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
Okay. Anything else to add?
We hope you'll support this, and thank you for not being too hard on me.
You were never too hard on me either, Dr. Cole. Representative Hayden, would you like to...
Thank you.
Wait, over here, yes. Would you like to Comment on this bill or on a different bill?
On this bill, I think, sir.
Okay.
About 10 minutes, if I may.
Please. We had two ex-representatives in the room. We had Representative Anderson, too, who I don't see right now, but he'll be back, I suspect.
Mr. Chairman and members, thank you for the opportunity.
Are you okay?
Am I okay? Yeah, you sound really rough.
Oh, no, I'm on the downside. I mean, on the good side.
Okay.
You should have seen me yesterday. Please, Doctor.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity to appear before you briefly. For the record, my name is Cedric Caden. I'm a dentist from Fall Creek, Oregon. I vetted my testimony today with the bill sponsor, Representative Maurer, and with Dr. Peter Kohler, and they thought it might be appropriate information to give to you at this time, although, as Dr. Kohler says, we are not part of the project, although if invited, we might be able to help in some way. I do sit on, I do have extensive experience with OHP clients. I sit on the OHP contractors, on the medical dental board of directors, and the DCO contractors board. I'm currently director of a Oregon dental care organization providing oral health services to some 40 to 45,000 Oregonians, of whom about 30,000 are on the OHP plan, and I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2946. I think this is an appropriate move in the right direction. I would also like to tell the committee that we have been operating a program with some of the modalities of this bill for the last 5 years, with some success, limited in some areas. We would, the thing that in this bill that caught my attention was the telemedicine. We operate a van that operates in rural and frontier parts of Oregon, and we could upgrade that to use the telemedicine facilities. And that's why I chose to testify on this bill, that by satellite we could use some of these modalities, conferring between patient, and we speak not of medical assistant, but dental assistant, between patient, dental assistant, and dentist in a remote locality, and make speedy diagnoses. Currently, we're capable of treating about 8,000 clients with our infrastructure, and I have submitted for your inspection one copy, and it is one copy because it is 66 pages. Madam Administrator, if you would like more copies, we can get those for you by next week.
We'll enter into the record.
Okay.
Right. Anybody wants to look at it, we can get it to them.
Yeah. Okay. There it defines our program as a pilot project for mobile oral and physical health to the rural and frontier regions of Oregon, which currently have inadequate and unacceptable access of less than 1%, 0.73%, for dental care. To explain, most of the dentistry funded by Department of Medical Assistance programs is done by managed care organizations on a capitated basis. These clients and dentistry has achieved excellent access, and I present dentistry today because I would like the legislature to take a holistic view of what we're doing. Dentistry is an important component of health, and I would like to keep dentistry in your mind as you proceed with these pilot programs. But we have penetration of about 91%. About 91% of the OHP clients have a managed care dental home. The remaining clients are placed on fee-for-service, and they're largely in the rural and frontier areas, way out in the outback. They're 50 or 100 miles from a town, maybe 150 miles from a dentist. They have great, huge, enormous, I can't overstate it, difficulty in accessing a dentist and getting care. As a matter of fact, in the back of your testimony, I have a handout taken from the Department of Human Services clipping service on a little boy that last month died for lack of a dentist, for lack of dental care. Many think that dental decay is an innocuous problem. It is not. It can be and sometimes is a fatal disease. It was in the case that I just presented to you. Every child, parent, and adult in Oregon is entitled to adequate oral health care. The vast majority have it. The disenfranchised few do not. Now, our pilot project, and I speak of it as a pilot project, even though it's been in existence for 5 years, because we would like to upgrade it with the telemedicine aspects that we're talking about, proposes to address this need by providing oral and perhaps medical health care to rural and frontier Oregon. Parenthetically, my son is an emergency medicine physician. We would use state-of-the-art telemedicine equipment to transmit digital x-rays taken by the dental assistant. We would transmit electronic records in a HIPAA-compliant status. We would do video conferencing and oral video scans of the patient so that the dentist could make a diagnosis remotely after seeing the x-rays, the records, and speaking verbally to the patient. After x-ray evaluation, prevention, and preliminary care by mid-level professionals, the dentist would travel to that rural location to provide the clinical dental services. Currently, our team, and we speak of a dental team, which is required to provide the services, is a driver technician to maintain the equipment, and with the backup of our IT guy, a dental assistant, a dental hygienist, and a dentist. That is the dental team that staffs these rural mobile vans. I stated that this is a pilot project, but it is in fact an ongoing program that's been functioning since 2001. Unfortunately, for reasons that I am not privy to, it has never developed its full potential. The program is capable of treating some 8,000 clients. Like the 5,000 that Dr. Kohler wants, you need critical mass in order to make a program like this work, to make it fiscally and statistically viable. We have, for the past 5 years, been allowed to treat some 300 patients, which leaves some 7,700 patients without access in rural Oregon. And so I speak to you today in hopes of jump-starting this program. We would respectfully suggest it's a project that's good for Oregon and Oregonians. In the back of the binder, a number of states have done this. Some states have three of these. One state has three vans just for the developmentally disabled. Texas has model legislation for their mobile dental vans. Oregon has other dental and medical vans that operate, such as Northwest Medical Teams. But there are none that are really functioning to capacity within the Department of Medical Assistance Program's contracts. This is not an expensive program. This is a capitated program. It costs about $20 per month to care for these people, of which, good news, only about $7 is state general fund, and the rest is federal funds.
Dr. Hayden, I hate to interrupt you, but
I'm done.
Okay, I'm not sure how it's relevant to this bill, although I'm glad you support this bill.
All right. Because we would be using many of these things, and we would probably need legislative permission in order to use dental assistance in this manner. We would also probably need the dental funding in Senate Bill 519, which I could testify on, in order to have teleconferencing paid for as a patient contact.
We need to have this in the context of a different bill, I think.
Thank you. I apologize then. We thought this might be appropriate, but I have overstepped my welcome.
You have no overstepped your welcome. It's just I want to make sure you're welcome in a way that's useful.
All
perhaps
right.
You and Mr. Edge could check in on that, and we'll see if we have another vehicle to...
Very good. Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you so much for coming. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2946. We'll await some amendments and an amendment and the possibility of getting rid of the subsequent referral to Ways and Means, which would help move things along. Sandy, if you'll explore that with the Speaker's office. And we may need to check in with LFO first, I suppose. But if LFO asks HHS, DHS, is there a fiscal, and they say no, it might make it a lot easier.
And they would have, Mr. Chair, they would have to look at the amendment in the context of the original bill also, and then they could give us a preliminary estimate on the direction.
Great. Thank you very much for coming. I'm going to reopen the hearing on House Bill 2918. And we need to get a couple of witnesses on by conference call first before we move to others here. So who do we have?
We have Michelle Trivedi, who is, I believe, will be calling in Indiana. She is an advocate and part of the Indiana Autism Insurance Mandate Conference, calling Sue, Representative Buckley's.
Okay, you'll be able to. You think you're going to be able to manage?
And I have the technician there as my backup.
Okay.
Because I freak out so bad.
None of us are convinced we know how to use the phone system here.
Your call has been forwarded to an automatic voice message system.
There you go.
Michelle Trevetti.
Is not available. To page this person, press 5 now. At the tone, please record your message. When you have finished recording, you may hang up or press 1 for more options.
Michelle, this is Sandy Teeley Circa from the House Subcommittee on Healthcare Access calling you for a conference call. It is 4:15 Oregon time. I'm not sure what time it is in your home state. I will try, we might try back in a little bit, or otherwise I will connect with you when the meeting's over. And I don't have a phone number where you can call us back at. So I'll try in a little bit. Thanks.
Okay.
I'm going to try the other. And Susan Klein is who I'm attempting to know. She is Representative Buckley's constituent.
Hello?
Susan?
Yeah.
This is Sandy from the House Subcommittee on Healthcare Access.
Well, hi, Sandy.
Hi. Sorry we're a little late. We heard from the members and then we reconvened for the public hearing. So you are on the conference call right now and the committee is available to hear your testimony.
Oh, okay. Well, actually, I was only planning on to respond if there were questions that people had. There's quite a group of people there, and they have an agenda in a sort of sequence of order that I had sent earlier today where they were hoping to go down a certain sequence of presenters.
Okay, well, we thought we were going to have somebody from Indiana, and that's not working.
And all I got from Michelle Trevetti is her voicemail, so we might be a little late with her.
Okay.
Would you like to...
happy to... just share from I'm on the Board of Living Opportunities, which is a program for adults with disabilities in Jackson County, and I work with young kids with disabilities, and I am a member of Stand for Children, and it's a continuing problem that I've seen in Oregon of not having adequate services.
Excuse me just a moment. Do you say there is a list, there's an agenda?
Yes, I forwarded it to Andrew earlier today, and of a group of presenters, and they should be...
To Andrew?
To Andrew, yeah, I sent it earlier, and there's a parent there, and...
Who's Andrew?
Andrew is Peter's assistant, Peter Buckley's assistant.
Does somebody here have that list?
I don't see it.
Because I don't have it.
And Michelle Vanderway from the Northwest Autism Foundation should be there, and she probably has the list.
Michelle Vanderway here?
Michelle Vanderway.
I have Michelle Trevetti's testimony. I'm more than happy to read it for you in her absence. And she was on the line at 3 o'clock, but I think she had to go on to work, so when we changed the order.
And you have a list of other people who you want to...
Yeah, everybody's signed in, so in order.
Everybody's signed, not on the form I have, is there? I have Michelle Vanderway, Bob Nickel, Kendra and Keeley, Peter Gill, Mike Dewey, and Dr. Larry Krupa. Is that the list? Okay, do you want to start? And you can either stay on the phone or you can testify, whatever is your pleasure.
Well, I really feel like my part of getting this going is done, and that these people probably have more powerful things to say than I do, and I would be happy to answer any questions at the end of their testimony if people have any, but
okay.
I think they are the people that should say what they need to say.
And you're welcome to hang on the phone if you'd like.
Okay, that'd be great.
Okay, then let's go.
Would you please introduce yourself?
Yes, my name is Michelle Vanderway. I am a parent of an 8-year-old child with autism. I appreciate your time, Representative Greenlich and members of the committee.
Excuse me a moment. Representative Edwards, would you like to come up? Want to join us up here? More comfortable. I'm sorry for interrupting.
Please, I can share space.
You have to get through the dais.
We have a PowerPoint presentation that kind of gives an overview of the intent of HB 2918 that Representative Buckley has, and I believe he's been called to come back into the room. In the interest of time, I would like to go ahead and read Michelle Trivedi's testimony. She was instrumental in passing a similar autism mandate in the state of Indiana, and she has submitted her comments on this bill and in our efforts to pass this. Michelle Trivedi has a master's degree in health service administration from Xavier University.
Is this the testimony that's 5 pages long?
Yes, I'm going to condense it.
If you would condense it, we all have it.
Okay. And basically, it was through her efforts in Indiana. You heard from Senator Buckley's testimony that there have been several states that have passed similar legislation that we're asking to have passed here today. And through this process, the parallels that we'll make are the Indiana legislature and the mandate that was passed there have very similar qualities and characteristics of the one that we're submitting today. The Indiana health insurance mandate for autism requires individual group and HMO-based policies to cover treatment for autism as defined in the DSM-4 in accordance with a written treatment plan. And employers affected by the mandate include small and large businesses alike. Approximately 70 to 75% of businesses in Indiana are self-insured and therefore exempt from the India mandate law. I'm going to draw some parallels because some of the issues that may be raised in the process of this bill will be similar to ones that were addressed in Indiana. Before the law was passed, the insurance lobby and small business lobby made apocalyptic predictions that this mandate would send them into bankruptcy, that autism was too expensive to treat, that insurance rates would jump by at least 10 to 20%, and that businesses would stop offering health insurance. After 6 years of implementing this law, none of these predictions have come to pass. Insurance rates continue to climb at the same rate as they did before the autism mandate, and the insurance industry has reported record profits and record executive compensation. Indiana ranks among the unhealthiest states in terms of lifestyle diseases relating to smoking, obesity, and risk behaviors. Indiana has an autism rate of about 1 in 150 births. Insurers also argued that the autism mandate was not needed because we had a mental health parity law. However, the reality was that the insurers under this mandate covered none of the most effective and prescribed treatments for autism, such as ABA therapy, speech therapy, occupational therapy, and physical therapy. The current commissioner of the Indiana Department of Insurance was a Republican state representative at that time that the autism insurance mandate was passed. Usually anti-mandate, the autism mandate is the only health insurance mandate he ever supported. The legislators who supported the autism mandate did not view the legislation as special treatment for autism, but as a necessary correction to the discriminatory practice of the insurance industry. Autism is the only neurological disorder that is routinely denied any coverage. There are no financial, clinical, or cost arguments to refuse coverage for autism that hold water when compared to other conditions and populations that are routinely covered. After the Indiana autism mandate went into effect, several of the self-insured companies in Indiana also followed suit. And one of the most important points about that is that self-insurers, obviously, they have the ability to choose or not to choose based on how they see the treatment being covered and the costs associated with that coverage. While no businesses or insurance companies have gone bankrupt because of the autism mandate in Indiana, families have been spared from bankruptcy because of it. Indiana has one of the highest personal bankruptcy and foreclosure rates in the country, and the number one reason for this is medical expenses. Several families have commented that they would be bankrupt, lose their home, or would have to quit a job if it weren't for the autism mandate. What she is saying and what we are trying to derive as a comparison here is that throughout this process, there will be much argument and testimony about the increasing cost if autism is covered, what you have heard from Representative Buckley and others, and what you will hear from other testimony here today, is that autism is a neurological disorder. And for various reasons, it has been, to this point, very much excluded from insurance coverage. And what we are finding, to answer some of the questions that were addressed before, is that while we do have some legislative support, and while we did get Senate Bill 1 passed, there are still significant types of treatments that are scientifically based and proven to be effective for children with autism that are still not covered, that the children desperately need. Some of the key elements to the Indiana mandate that we are modeling after is the care plan describes which services are medically necessary. This means that the treating physicians are treating the children with autism, and they are the ones who are determining what is medically necessary. Indiana, as in Oregon, currently does not have a licensing requirement for providers of specialty therapy services, and that is one of the things that we're faced in Oregon, is that certain providers that can provide very effective treatments for the children with autism cannot provide those treatments for the children with insurance coverage because the language that currently is in place requires state licensing requirements, and there is no state licensing requirement or ability to get a state license in the state of Oregon for these therapists. So we're kind of caught between a rock and a hard place. And by submitting this bill, we are very much in hopes that that will curb this process and allow effective treatments to be actually delivered to the children. The legislator formed a benefits mandate study group to evaluate the cost and benefits of the several health benefits mandates in Indiana. To date, the group has not published a full study on any of the benefit mandates, mainly due to a lack of response from insurers for data and information. However, the Council for Affordable Health Insurance and Anti-Benefit Mandate Group has determined that an autism mandate, and this was in Indiana, will cost less than a 1% increase in premiums. That is in contrast to a 5 to 10% increase for mental health parity in that state, a 1 to 3% cost for an acupuncturist mandate, and a 3 to 5% increase for dentists. And in the testimony, it shows a link to that study. And again, on her behalf, she is thanking everybody for the opportunity to support this bill.
Thank you very much. You have testimony, right?
I can give testimony.
If you want to.
I would be happy to. I didn't write personal testimony for today. I'm reading to other pretty powerful testimonies, but I would love the opportunity to do that if it's acceptable not to submit a written.
Why don't you briefly make a personal statement? That would be fine.
Okay. I'll make this quick. As I mentioned, I am the mother of an 8-year-old daughter, or 8-year-old son, rather, with autism, and a 9-year-old daughter who is typically developing. I am a single mother. So I can, while I can't speak to the exact percentages of number of single mothers out there dealing with this condition, the numbers are high. And what I can speak to is what autism really looks like, what it is for a single parent, and what the challenges have been. And I will try to make this very brief. Autism in 2.5 minutes, right? Mm-hmm. My son was diagnosed in 2002. He's 8 years old right now. I am going to try to get through this without too much emotion, but I have been one of the ones who have fallen through the cracks in having to make decisions between whether I provide medical treatment for my son or therapy that he needs. I have a job. My job has allowed me to be incredibly flexible. For that, I am very lucky. I am able to work from home 3 days a week and in the office 2 days a week. I have continued to cut back hours due to lack of sleep and exhaustion of caring for a child who does not sleep through the night and who goes through sleep deprivation patterns, as I would call them, for 2 to 3 weeks at a time. I am in a position right now where I cannot cut my hours back anymore or I will lose my job. So I have to suck it up, and for the rest of his life as I'm working, this is my fate. Autism, there are clinical definitions of autism that are out there that I believe many people have seen already. What autism really is, for many of the kids, a lot of the stats out there are for classic autism. That means the severe children who cannot talk, who cannot walk with a steady gait, who cannot function on their own, and have trouble with receptive and expressive language skills. It is, the reality of it is not being able to take a shower in the morning and go to work until your child is safely at school, because there is a very great likelihood that he will escape from the home. It is going to the restroom and 2 minutes later having a neighbor knock on your door because they have found him walking in the middle of the street with a shirt and a diaper on at age 7. It is trying to take care of a daughter at the same time and not being able to play a game or watch a movie or rest for even 5 minutes, because most of these children do not stop. They literally keep moving from the minute they wake up to the minute that they go to bed. It is being publicly humiliated by non-understanding people in the community when you're trying really hard to incorporate this child into a regular environment and having them not understand that your child isn't just spoiled, rotten, and just trying not to get their way, but they have extreme sensory conditions where if you're at a park and an ice cream truck comes by and the sound is too loud, they'll have complete meltdowns and start smashing their heads on the floor. It is putting your 8-9-year-old daughter in counseling from the trauma of ER visits, paramedics, firemen coming to the doors, of losing sight of Hans for a minute and being scared he's never going to come back. The really less glamorous side is of going to get him in the morning, find out he has woken up and had, this is public record. diarrhea, diapers from GI tract problems, and has decided to try to help himself and have feces smeared all over the floor, all over the ceiling, all over himself and everything he's touched in the process, all the way down the stairs, into the kitchen, downstairs, into the room to watch TV, and trying to figure out how to sterilize the home so that people can walk, and having to call your parents who are retired and ask them to come get the kids so you can spend 8 hours scrubbing the house. It is at times going to medical physicians because your kid has medical issues and having them tell you that the reason they hurt and the reason they cry is because they have autism. And to find out later, after putting him on a plane to Boston to a doctor who will listen, that he has mercury poisoning, ileal lymphoid, nodular hyperplasia, candida, colitis, and is allergic to his own neuro tissue. And then having the insurance company come back and pay 15% of that because he had to go out of state. It is making choices between medical care and therapy care because you can only pick one, because after the bills, you only have so much spendable income left because insurance hasn't covered anything, so you have to make decisions. It's about hearing testimony and being on panels and working really hard on bills to get things changed. But you find out that even though all that's done, and even though you went through all that hard work, that there are stipulations and wording that prevent the people who could actually help the most from helping the most. It's about a serious financial impact on the state of Oregon if we don't change things now. I'm a financial analyst so I can put the numbers to it, like the best of them. And it's really not pretty on the average. There's stats that indicate, and we'll show them to you later, how many millions of dollars on average it takes to treat one child. We have over 6,000 children currently in the school system right now diagnosed with autism. Nationally, the rate is increasing between 10 and 17% year over year. The number's not getting any smaller, and neither are the costs to treat the children if we don't do something now. And if we don't do something now to help prevent the astronomical costs that are going to hit us one way or the other down the line. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that testimony.
Any questions? Hard to follow up with questions.
Yeah. Can I make a comment, Chair?
Please do.
I've been an educator for almost 20 years, and I'm fortunate because I love all children, and I especially love special ed students. And when I became assistant principal, because I worked with an autistic child and was blessed, just absolutely blessed to have him as a student. And he'd always come up when I became assistant principal and give me a hug in the mornings because I built this rapport with him in the classroom. And his peers didn't understand that because Ray always smelled because his biggest goal was to learn how to take a shower by himself. And some of his peers would come over and go, "Miss Comp, how can you give that guy a hug? He stinks." And I said, "I know, but he's just Ray and he loves to give hugs." And the rest of the story is because he was so determined as an individual, he did graduate with a regular diploma. And my most inspirational moment as an educator was when his peers stood up and gave him a standing ovation at graduation. And it still makes my heart sing to know that they learned to really respect what Ray was at as a person. And now I see him on the streets in Woodburn just a couple years later, and he's taking care of his mom.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Any other questions? Representative Buckley, is there a PowerPoint presentation?
There was one presented. My L.A. went home ill. with the flu.
I can relate to that. Yeah, okay.
I can provide that for you at additional hearing if you like.
That would be great. Thank you very much.
Sure. I have additional testimony to read for two other people today, and I can continue with that if you would like.
Yes, can you, again, be relatively brief with it, mm-hmm. and then we'll enter the whole. You have the written testimony.
Yeah, you can go next. She's going to let me go now.
Yes.
You can draw.
Welcome to both of you. Would you both please introduce yourself?
My name is Kendra Pettengill, and I'm from Roseburg, Oregon.
And I am Keely Pettengill. I'm from school in third grade.
Okay.
At Glide Elementary School.
Did you not have to go to school today?
Yes.
Half a day.
Half a day.
Okay.
Because I didn't really get lunch today.
Oh, no.
Neither did we.
Okay.
We'll make sure you get dinner.
Yes, please go ahead.
I'm going to read this, and I'm fairly quick. So the CDC recently announced that 1 in every 150 children in America have autism. In New Jersey, the numbers are 1 in every 94, and here in Oregon, 1 in 98. To put this in perspective for you, the worst year of the polio epidemic in America was 1952, and the numbers are approximated at 1 in every 4,000 children. The Oregon Department of Education has a chart showing that in the early 80s, there were 3 children listed as autistic on the special education rosters in Oregon. In 2006, as you've heard, we surpassed 6,000 children in Oregon with the same diagnosis. Without appropriate insurance, educational, and treatment programs, we can only imagine the impact on our state and country in the next 10 to 20 years
as one in every 98 children are applying for Social Security disability benefits instead of going on to college or jobs. We are soon to experience the effects of our neglect of this disease for the last 20 years, and it will no longer be denied as an epidemic, as what is coming is a tsunami of devastating proportions. So the question to be answered here must be, is autism treatable? And what kind of a difference can you make by paying for and supporting the treatment of autism? My daughter Keely here was born in June of 1998, a perfectly healthy baby at birth, progressed normally in every way, meeting every milestone, sitting, walking, talking, playing, and loving. Following a severe reaction to her vaccines at 15 months, resulting in collapse in the doctor's office, organ failure, severe fever, and a two-week hospitalization, my child was gone. She never returned from that incident. She was now in her own world. She stopped talking, stopped making eye contact, had trouble walking, spent her days rocking incessantly, flapping her hands, banging her head constantly against any hard surface she could find, including furniture or even cement. She would have literally hundreds of meltdowns a day, making it impossible to leave the house, to shop, go to restaurants. She refused to be touched by people she once knew and loved. She limited her food intake to three foods. She couldn't handle most noises, and everyday life seemed impossible and insurmountable. She was in a vicious cycle of chronic infections and antibiotic treatments. So I kept returning to the pediatrician, pleading with him to help us, that whatever happened to her was not going away. He had no answers and didn't seem interested in finding them. He told me originally just to give her time to recover, but eventually that didn't work anymore. Instead of listening to the symptoms, he turned it on me. I was just overprotective because of her near-death experience. My child would be sick 100 times more in her life, he told me. You can't overreact. It was a phase, and I was being overprotective, overreacting. When that didn't work anymore, he hinted at Munchausen by proxy and asked me, so do you want something to be wrong with your child? I went outside of our caregivers to get her diagnosis, without referrals and out of my own pocket. I had to go out of my way and pay out of my own pocket simply to get the diagnosis that no parent in this earth ever wants to hear, autism. It was 2 years after her plunge into autism that I finally got the diagnosis, two precious years wasted. I was then told she was severely mentally retarded, she would never talk again, and I should get a lawyer and financial specialist to set up what they call a life plan. And this is where instead of a retirement account and college savings, it all should be loaded into an account that would care for her in an institution or group home after I have died. This is what I was told to look forward to. Imagine being told I must plan not for a future, but for death and her institutionalization. Imagine being told your child will never love nor even care whether I exist or not, will never say the word mommy to me, and certainly never uttered the words, I love you. She would never attend regular school, never learn a skill, never drive, go to a prom, marry, have children of her own. I had to wonder what would happen to her in an institution, unable to communicate with others. Would she be molested and unable to tell anyone what was happening? I was given no hope, and in fact, I was told there was nothing I or anyone else could do. There's no cure, no treatment. Just take her home and love her until you can't physically handle her anymore, and then put her in the institution. Instead, I found not from doctors, not from school systems or early intervention or my government or nonprofits that are supposedly there to help the disabled, but from the internet and from other parents of autistic children, that autism is not the hereditary disease they want us to believe, and I guess I had already figured that part out. It attacks the nerves in the brain, it attacks their digestive system or gut, and it wipes out their immune system. On top of what is done to their brain, they are unable to digest their food and are constantly ill. Ear infections, bladder infections, you name it. Our children seem to be stuck on sick. I decided to do a life plan, but my life plan would have nothing to do with institutions or group homes. We started with healing her gut and hence went on a diet recommended for autistic children, removing all gluten and casein, no wheat or dairy products, and it was one of the hardest things I've ever done. But it had a miraculous effect. After about 1 week of what looked like someone withdrawing from heroin, it was as if a light had returned to her eyes. 2 weeks into the diet, Keely spoke for the first time in 2 years, so one prediction down that she would never talk again. I lived in a strange balance of joy and fear, joy at the changes in my daughter, and fear that what we were doing, that we were doing this totally alone. No doctors, no nutritionists, no support. I read about parents in New York whose children were taken away from them for putting them on the exact same diet. But whenever I tried to stop the diet, she'd return to biting herself and pulling her own hair out in frustration. I could not stop the diet. So I dedicated myself to a self-education program that made my collegiate years look like grammar school. I became a doctor, nutritionist, a nurse, a dietitian, an ABA specialist, and I would go it alone. No expert advice, no insurance coverage, no assistance whatsoever. My insurance company simply dropped us when we got the diagnosis. I found applied behavioral analysis that makes a huge difference in our children, even completely recovering some children to indistinguishable from their peers. Yet we are discouraged and we refused help by our school districts and insurance companies. If we were living in New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Minnesota, or California and other states, we would have received 40 hours of ABA a week at no cost to us. But my daughter is denied this simply by misfortune of location. Our school district refused to even discuss ABA therapy with us, so our only choice to ensure the best practice and continuity of therapy and methodology was to either remove her from the inadequate school program or become legal experts and file due process and take them to court to provide an appropriate education. Our schools talked to us about budget restraints and setting dangerous precedents, but not once did I ever hear the words, "What is best for Keeley?" ABA was dismissed as too expensive without regard for effect, long-term costs, or proven efficacy. This from a school that throws special ed money in their general fund where it is just as likely to buy a football helmet as help my child. I find the school set an extremely low bar of expectations for autistic children, and it shouldn't surprise anyone if our children never surpass that bar. Those of us doing home ABA programs set the bar much higher, and our children are meeting and exceeding those high expectations. Parents are proving the schools wrong. Our autistic children are not the problem, but lack of knowledge on the parts of our schools, failure to use proven methodology and efficacious treatments, and a lack of commitment and dedication to helping our children achieve at the highest level is the problem. My insurance company will not pay for medical therapies, the diet, ABA therapy, and nothing we need. In fact, once autism is diagnosed, they can refuse to pay for a doctor's visit for the flu if your doctor checks the little autism box on the insurance sheet. My insurance company... I already said it. Every nonprofit or government organization I contacted denied me assistance as they say my $30,000 a year income is too much to qualify. Or believe it or not, they would say my daughter was not disabled enough. Despite being the first person in my family to ever receive a college degree, I've joined the ranks of the working poor, the lower middle class, and the uninsured. When parents find out on our own that there is hope, we're discouraged by physicians that know little to nothing about cutting-edge information and seem to have no interest in learning. Children needlessly suffer because too many physicians feel that conditions that would be aggressively diagnosed and or treated in typical children are just part of being autistic. It seems to be okay if our children are in pain. I'm not just alone because I'm a single parent of an autistic child. I'm alone because my community, my school district, my employer, my medical providers, my insurance company, my government, my state, and even agencies meant to help families such as mine have all abandoned us and our children. It's a sad day when the state of Oregon and its institutions have decided that one in every 98 children is expendable. I've sold my house, I've spent my retirement, lost my medical insurance, all to save my life, my child from a life of hopelessness. My entire family is affected by this. My parents sold their retirement home and moved by to help us out. I feel utterly alone and abandoned all but by family and my peers in the autism community. Over 5 years of biomedical treatment all on my own and 20 to 40 hours of ABA therapy a week, again, all on my own. My daughter now attends a typical third grade classroom without an aide or extra assistance and has now been deemed not qualified to receive special education assistance. She is fully included with her peers and performing the identical work, tasks, and activities and is receiving straight A's and B's on her report cards. She takes dance lessons and is learning to ski. She has a best friend. She's happy and a joy to be around. And now I hear I love you all the time. And we have what was once to me unimaginable, conversations about boys and why there's snow in the mountains. She's smart, inquisitive, a pretty darn typical kid. A few quirks here and there, but who doesn't have quirks? And I'll take those quirks any day over the prognosis we were given. The biggest shock after receiving the diagnosis was realizing that parents of autistic kids are treated differently. The minute you get the diagnosis, you meet hostility, and paranoia from caregivers, school officials, insurance reps, nonprofits, government agencies, even politicians. What is it that makes us so different from the parents of children with Down syndrome or cerebral palsy? Why are we cut out of normal society and treated as lepers? I see in the news the CDC, the FDA, physicians claiming that the parents of autistic children are wackos, out on the fringe, experimenting on their own children with unproven treatments and diets and trying to find something to blame their child's condition, whether it's vaccines or mercury. But I've learned we act differently because we are treated differently. We are out on the fringes because we've been forced out there by every entity that should be helping us, that in every other aspect of life they are there to help, to guide, and to support. We've been taught and learned well that it's all up to us. We have to be demanding, we have to educate ourselves, and we have to become advocates, because if we do not advocate and fight for our children, it's obvious no one else is going to do it. Lastly, I'd like to say I was impressed by the recent bill that mandated that substance abuse recovery be covered by insurance. But I find it hard to believe that the honorable men and women of our state legislature would believe so strongly in giving grown people who have maybe made some poor choices in their lives a second chance, but would not feel as strongly or even more so about giving innocent children the same rights and privileges. After all, these kids aren't asking for a second chance. They're asking for the first one, for any chance at a normal and functional life. No more parents like me should have to become a doctor, nurse, nutritionist, dietitian, teacher, ABA consultant, special ed lawyer, professional advocate. Every parent has a right to be just that, a parent, allowed to devote their time to nurturing, raising, supporting, loving, and just enjoying their child. This coverage is critical to that mission, critical to the children and the future of the great state of Oregon. The words of Laura Bono of the National Autism Association tells us everything that we need to know if we do not act. She said, the light at the end of the tunnel is an oncoming train. Frankly, we don't know what we're going to do. And at the bottom, I put my motto, if you think you're too small to make a difference, you've never been in bed with a mosquito.
Thank you very much.
Any questions? And you may ask her questions if you'd like. I think she's her own testimony. The money is well spent.
Going to school in third grade.
Very, very proud of you. Thank you very much. I'd like to call Shelley Bain up, if you don't mind coming up, because I don't think we did think we left autism out when we passed parity. I think that either as a neurological disorder or as a mental health disorder, we think we included it. So I'm curious whether we did or didn't include it. Could you introduce yourself and help us with that question?
My name is Shelley Bain. I'm Senior Policy Analyst for the Insurance Division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And I believe, Chair Green, what you're referring to is Senate Bill 1 and whether or not autism is included. And in the definition, when the department did do administrative rules, autism is included in the definition of mental nervous condition. I think, however, what you're hearing in some of the testimony today is that Senate Bill 1 did set out a list of providers that are covered under that bill, and the providers that some of these parents are referring to are not in that list of providers, and how that exactly works with Senate Bill 1, I don't know that we really know yet, as far as whether or not the insurance companies are going to cover it. Senate Bill 1 has taken effect. Okay.
If I have a stroke,
right,
I'm sure speech pathology will be covered, and occupational therapy, and
right.
I mean, in fact, I've had that happen in the last 3 months where I got occupational therapy and physical therapy, but a stroke is a neurological disorder, mm-hmm. You might know. Did you leave occupational therapy and physical therapy and speech pathology out of covered services for mental health disorders or for neurological disorders?
Well, we didn't actually put it in or take it out. That would have been the legislature. I think most insurance...
You said you listed as a part of the,
no,
the administrative
what we
procedure providers that are covered or not
the
covered.
The providers, and those are mental health providers that are listed in the actual bill, not an administrative rule. In the actual bill, Senate Bill 1 lists the mental health providers that are covered, that insurance companies have to cover the treatments of those providers. And that was in the legislation, not in the administrative rule.
Clear as mud, I think. Do you have any questions?
Yes. I'm trying to understand this a little better. Are you saying that, and I wasn't here for Senate Bill 1, are you saying that Senate Bill 1 applied a mandate, but only to certain carriers or certain
Lighters.
Types of
Lighters.
Policies?
Lighters.
Certain types of providers.
Carriers, but that's not what she's talking about.
Yes, certain types of providers. In Senate Bill 1, it does say these providers must be, the services of these providers must be covered.
And follow up.
Psychiatrists.
Right.
And
psychiatrists, mental health providers.
Okay, yes. And those, and that includes the types of providers that a family working with an autistic child would see?
I am not an expert on the type of provider a family with an autistic child would see. I do know that the ABA therapy, those providers that provide the ABA therapy were not in the list of providers that are covered by, and I don't believe, although again I'm not an expert, I don't believe ABA therapy is considered a mental therapy.
And that's consistent with the testimony that we've heard
yes.
Today. So Senate Bill 1 did not go to the extent that folks who have testified here would like it to, because it didn't include on that list of providers some of the ones that are necessary for a child, a person with autism. Is there a separate issue about the insurers? This is where I thought you were going,
okay.
Shelley, the insurers that were subject to the mandate under Senate Bill 1.
No, okay, there is a difference in this bill and Senate Bill 1 in that this bill would cover individual health benefit plans. Senate Bill 1 only covers group health benefit plans. So that is a difference. As far as the insurance companies, both bills would cover any insurance company that offers a health benefit plan. But like I said, Senate Bill 1 only covers group, where this bill would cover individual
okay.
as well as group.
That's very helpful. Thank you.
Representative Buckley, would you chime in? Okay. And if autism is defined as a neurological disorder, then would it not be covered as any other health? I mean, certain services might still be not covered, and we'll hear from at least one insurance company in a moment.
Mm-hmm.
But it would be basically covered, would it not, in terms of services?
I believe that services that are considered medically necessary in most instances would be covered. Historically, before Senate Bill 1 was passed, some insurance companies did exclude coverage for autism because autism does fall under the definition of mental nervous in the DSM. I don't believe that we would approve a policy now that did exclude autism, whether that be mental or physical. But there were historically, yes, plans that did.
Thank you very much. Is Mike Dewey still here, or did I just see him?
Okay.
Oh, there he is. You did. Mike, would you join us? And this is Shelley, thank you very much. You were on the list. I appreciate you being available to answer questions for us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike Dewey, representing ODS Companies. Let me say I'm not an expert here by any means on this subject. And I haven't had, because of another hearing, the opportunity to hear all the testimony. I know what has been said has been very compelling about families and children, and we have great empathy for what has been said here. This is and this committee knows these are very complex issues. And we're not going to solve anything today in the sense that the science in terms of what people believe is a little bit different. I think we can all probably agree to that as to how you treat autism and can you treat autism and who should provide that treatment. So let me say that the way the bill is written, we have to oppose the bill. There are, we think, ways to make it better, and it would take some time to do that. But nonetheless, we talked about some of the providers that are not covered. And in part, as I understand it, we talked about the ABA, not the American Bar Association, but the behavioral analysts. And we're always concerned about credentialing in terms of who's providing a service. We have our providers that are licensed. As I understand it, these individuals are not licensed. So you get into a number of issues. They may have some credentials, but it gets to the real question of licensing. So that's an issue for us. There is a provision in the bill, it would be a delegation of authority that we don't think you can do in terms of how the definition would change over time. And we don't think you can do that statutorily. I won't go into that at this point because we can have that discussion at another time. I think the issue in part is what is medically necessary and what is the best proven treatment. And quite frankly, as we understand it today, and this is the medical science as we understand it, there is no proven treatment. There is some outpatient therapy that can occur. It doesn't happen very often. There is speech and physical therapy that occurs under these policies. But nonetheless, for the total treatment over time, as I understand it, the best science today, the best management of this, says that there is no proven treatment. And that's the kind of the issue here. We are concerned about cost. As we increase cost, I mean, clearly the conundrum is, can we afford insurance? And it was very interesting when we had the mental health parity discussion, and it was a very interesting discussion. We had a number of people who came in, and this was the panacea, and they didn't have insurance. So you see that conundrum, if you will, in the sense that we don't want people who have insurance today who, because of mandates, and it's not just one, it's mandates over time that increase the cost of insurance. Now, we can make the case over time the cost of insurance will go down because we're doing good things. I mean, I haven't seen that, quite frankly, in my 34 years of work in this body, because when we talk about incarceration, we continue to talk about that. We talk about schools and problems in schools, we continue to talk about that. Now I'm getting off another tangent, but nonetheless, this increased cost causes us a concern, and we need to bring that forward to you. And I will finish with two other thoughts. When we talked about mental health parity compared to physical health therapy, the proponents said it would be in the neighborhood of a 1% increase in premium. And we want to see how that works out, because we, quite frankly, think it will be higher than that. And no matter what, we're going to abide by the law and we're going to provide full parity. But we want to wait and see how this works. So it may be premature to make significant changes, notwithstanding the discussion that has been made here. And we've had the discussion of medically fragile children. And quite frankly, a lobbyist is just not going to get up who represents an insurance company and debate that issue. You know, you just don't feel very good about it, and we don't feel good about having to be here to talk about this issue. But it's important to put these issues on the table. I think last but not least, with regard to individual policies compared to group policies, you may have problems if this moves forward with individual policies. You may not be able to get one. And that's why with mental health parity it was on the group side, because if somebody had a mental condition, a disorder, if you will, parity would have kicked in, costs would have gone up, and they wouldn't have been able to get coverage anyway. At least I think that would have been the case. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm going to say for the second time, I'm not the expert here. And for most of your questions, I would say that we can bring in the people that deal with this every day. We were not able to do that. But we're happy to continue to have this discussion.
Mike, I do want to ask you this question. Because of an assignment I had dealing as an epidemiologic consultant on the question of thimerosal in immunizations, and it's the question of its etiological effect on the development of autism. I read about 10 cases of material on autism, so I've learned a little about it. And I understand the issue of ABA, and I understand the issue of the scientific disputes over diet and a variety of things. But we had testimony earlier that a child with, whether it's a neurological or a mental health disorder, whatever it is, was denied services for things like occupational therapy, physical therapy, speech pathology, things that would seem to be a part of normal medical care coverage.
Mr. Chair, it's in having a conversation with somebody a little bit earlier, again, that does this on a daily basis, that came up, and we made a phone call, and I believe that is cannot be the case under the present law. It's a covered service. That's my understanding.
You get insurance, at least.
But as you know, insurance is a very complex area, and I get very mixed up over our own personal insurance that we have in terms of what is covered. And so I can see where that is going to happen from time to time. But those are covered services, as I understand that.
We have one more witness, and I'd like to call that witness to join us. We're obviously going to continue this discussion. I know. I was going to get that in a minute. All right. I have an able assistant here who keeps me informed of everything I miss.
I'm not sure I want to answer the question anyway. So.
You have a question for Mike, is it?
Mm-hmm.
Please, go ahead.
I just wanted to see if I understood correctly that you said that
Dr.
under...
Dr. Larry Krupa?
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr.
Chair. No. Go ahead,
okay,
please.
Mr. Chair.
You just say we'll be next.
Under current law... For individuals, including my family, who have been specifically denied services covered for our other children, for our children with a disability, that is currently against the law?
Mr. Chair, and Representative Gelser, if you could ask that one more time, because I want to make sure I clearly understand.
Sure. Let me, may I?
Please.
I think I'm curious with that response. I may have been the person that provided that testimony.
Right.
Forgive me for using this personal experience, but I know many families who have had similar personal
That's
experiences.
That's why we're here.
And it might be hard to believe, but I consider myself a fairly good advocate for my child, and generally I'm pretty successful at being able to move through what's legal.
I bet you are.
Well, for my child, who does not have autism, he has a developmental delay, developmental disability, he is denied coverage for physical therapy, speech therapy, and occupational therapy. I wondered whether or not it was true it was because of his disability until in two separate instances with the same insurance carrier, he was denied coverage once for speech therapy, once for occupational therapy, when at the same time, another child in my family with the same not overall diagnosis, but the same specific speech disorder or fine motor disorder, was given coverage. He was denied because it came back uncovered for neurodevelopmental disorders. And so he could not get the same services, same provider, same parents, same diagnosis, same insurance carrier, same week.
Well, I, Mr. Chair and Representative Gelser, I really can't answer the question because I think it depends. It gets down to the diagnosis, and I'll get back, and I should have said this, and I'll come back to you. With regard to let's take autism and the diagnosis, the group under mental health parity, you have coverage for that diagnosis. And through the proper channels, whatever needs to be done to evaluate what is going on with that particular client, if you will. I think in your case, it gets down to the diagnosis and then what is medically necessary. And we're going to always have that debate. That's why we meet every 2 years, or whatever the case may be, is to have a discussion about updating the law and where the science is and so forth. But that's kind of where I would see that, is how you look at that, and then, you know, obviously you go back to the policy and what's covered in the policy. But again, I can't really get involved in your situation, but I think it's shed some light on this whole discussion.
Can I follow up, Mr. Chair, very quickly?
Is it too late for me to say something?
No, I know you've been trying. Okay.
Well, you know, having worked at both ends of the spectrum with little kids and adults with autism, I mean, and having gone to probably as many of the trainings on autism as possible, there is very clearly very strong research about what makes a difference for these kids. The feds paid the National Academy of Science to do an exhaustive review of all the research and all the literature, and really ABA makes a huge difference for children. If you can work with kids before they're 48 months, you can buy yourself 26 IQ points. Now, it doesn't sound like much, but it's the difference between potentially independence in a school setting or long-term residential care. And so, and you know, the thing about ABA that's challenging is that there is no credentialing program in Oregon for applied behavioral analysis. They don't have a system. Now, Bill Eric at Portland State University has suggested that, and actually has a training methodology that's happening through the university, but there's no Oregon credentialing process. But it really is the ABA with a professional and paraprofessionals implementing the plan that makes a difference to these kids. And it's lengthy amount of time, you know, 25 hours a week of direct service, but it's really short-lived. You know, it's for 2 to 3 years in many cases, and then these mm-hmm. kids mm-hmm. won't be on the system dole for the rest of their life, where if you look at the Harvard study recently that was put out in 2006, if you don't work with a person with autism, you can expect to spend $3.2 million over their lifetime. And so it's just so critical that we figure this out for these early, early children. And it's just good sense.
And the cost of that treatment is something like about $50,000 a year, is that right?
Yeah, you know, I think if you get some of the ABA piece covered with the medical insurance, you get some of the school piece covered by schools, then you do like what Indiana has done, where they actually have a Medicaid waiver there too for kids with autism. You're sort of distributing the load across a variety of systems instead of expecting one system to carry it all, because they can't. There's not a methodology currently to make it work. And so that's the advantage of the Indiana model, is that it helps to say that large burden of cost across a multitude of systems. Does that make sense?
No, I understand what you're saying, yes.
Yeah.
Let me just interrupt a minute. We have one more witness in this. We are clearly not going to get to SB 163. I really apologize to that, to the folks who are here for that, mostly folks who are in Salem anyhow, I think. I don't think there's anybody out of town on that. Yeah, it's basically...
Mr. Russell.
Do you... where's...
No, he's
Mr. Russell from also in the New York.
You're Salem.
Yeah. When will we hear it again? When's the next time we can carry it over to?
To the subcommittee would have to be Monday.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we can't move it to the full committee this time, so.
No, and today's only a public hearing, so.
Let's put a public hearing and perhaps work session for next Monday. Does that work all right for the folks who are here? If anybody's still here on Senate Bill 163, that's passed out of the Senate already, I take it.
Correct.
Does not work for you.
Yes.
I'd be happy to take testimony from you then if it doesn't.
It does work.
You say it does work for you.
It does work for you.
Great.
Okay.
Great.
So we'll put it
up. Is Monday okay?
We'll make it work. I suggest you don't need to apologize. You have the important.
I think Cindy can't make it on Monday.
Cindy, can you not make it on Monday? We always manage to miss you, I think, for some reason. Should we go to Wednesday?
So,
is
all these provider taxes that
Monday's
at
this
meeting?
Yes.
Oh, no.
Yeah, you've got issues there.
Are you going to hear this before that?
How long is it going to take?
163.
Should be.
Very brief.
Recording it, so it should take 5 minutes.
Okay, we'll start with 163.
Okay.
On Monday?
On Monday.
And go from there.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I usually say it was a pleasure to be here. I can't. That's what I said.
I think we're gonna need a follow-up. I still want to hear from Dr. Krupa, but I think we are going to follow up, and it would be very useful if some of the insurance company experts on this, Mike, and I know John Powell told me there's a Regents person who had hoped to get here today and couldn't get here. If we get some more insight into what is and isn't covered. It is going to be hard to create a statute that mandates a particular therapy. And so we still may end up with as much of an argument, even with the bill we have, over individual therapies, but it would be something useful to explore, and we'll follow up on this again if that works all right for you gentlemen.
Absolutely.
And can we bring Dr. Larry Krupa? Please. This is the first time I think we've gone over our time limit. I'm a little embarrassed by it, but this is important work we're doing. And Dr. Krupa, would you introduce yourself, please?
Chairman Greenlick and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Larry Krupa. I am with and represent, first of all, Northwest Early Childhood Institute, which I currently work with, but also the Oregon Pediatric Society. I have to speak today on the basis of my own experience of 30 years in private practice of pediatrics, plus for the last 3 years I've been specializing in the care and treatment of kids with behavior and developmental disabilities. So I would respectfully submit that I am here as an authority, and I wanted to speak to that a little bit.
Please.
First of all, I have some written testimony, and I'm not going to read that, but I will refer to it. And I'm just very thankful for the opportunity to speak. When you're a man in the street pediatrician, it's a very frustrating, especially to deal with these kinds of cases. And so I appreciate the ability to have the time to be able to do this. The first thing I'd like to really point out, and this may be the crux of the whole issue, is this notion of the early diagnosis of pervasive developmental disorders. We know, in the pediatric community, we are very busy right now with the idea of learning how to make this early diagnosis. But one of the biggest concerns that other pediatricians are saying is, what happens when we make the diagnosis? What's going to happen to these kids? So it's essential that on the other end of this effort to make the early diagnosis, that there's something that the solutions can be carried out. We know there are solutions. We have evidence that not only the ABA method of applied behavioral analysis is one method, but there are multiple methods of intensive behavioral intervention at a very early age that are helpful. I think that you should not worry too much about the, quote, mandate of a particular treatment, because one of the things that you find out about children that have this diagnosis is they do vary considerably. The heroic indication of an autism kind of situation, but that's not the only one. And the therapies can be varied, but I think that the bill can, and as stated, as the statement is that the therapy should be recommended by a particular qualified provider, and they're the ones that determine what the therapy should be, rather than have to specify every particular therapy that might be available. I guess another bottom line issue is the idea of parity. It seems to me that with particular respect to pervasive developmental disorders, we do now have information both on the basis of genetics that there are many cases of autism, and certainly not all of them, but many of them are hereditary, and we actually, in a couple of cases, know specific genes that are involved. For example, just recently, the Rett syndrome, which is in this category of disorders, has now a specific gene that's been identified. There's another uncommon cause of autism, which is caused by another, it's called a 15q deletion. It's another specific genetic abnormality that can cause autism. Most of the cases, the thinking is that these are multigenetic, but it's clearly a hereditary pattern within families. I think maybe the concept that might be helpful to think about is that which is called neuroplasticity. And what that basically means is that if you provide the kind of environment that the brain can learn from that environment how to work around the deficits that are present in these children, then you can see improvement. We know this from stroke patients. We know this from other kinds of mental problems, which can show improvement. But if you provide the right kind of environment, that these children can, in fact, get better. We have evidence of that. That's pretty much outlined in my statement, and I would certainly be willing to answer any questions anybody might have along those lines. Thank you.
I do have a question. There are sets of comorbidities that complicate this issue quite a bit, aren't they? Could you talk just a little bit about comorbidities?
Well, there are a lot of comorbidities, and I think that's the reason why you have to realize that the cases are different. You cannot just put them all in one box and call them autistic, because just for that very reason, there are a number of comorbidities, and they're age-related. For example, over and above the definition of autism, which right off the bat opens up the possibility of variance, because these children may or may not have overall intellectual impairment. They may or may not have difficulties with speech. They may have varying degrees of social recognition. But over and above those variances, which are really part of the basic definition of autism, there are also comorbidities, including oppositional defiant disorder. So these children get very severe behavioral problems, very oppositional. Attention deficit disorder, of course, is a biggie. As the kids grow older, oftentimes we have problems with depression.
Obsessive compulsive disorder
is another one. I think you can almost list every mental impairment that children can display that can be found in a higher degree in these categories of kids.
Next question.
Please.
First of all, if you could get a little bit further, it'll make a better record.
Thank you. I was trying to figure out what I can do to improve that, so thanks.
Dr. Krupa, we had testimony of one instance. In fact, you heard Ms. Pettengill speak about her daughter who in every way appeared to be fully normal and fully functioning until age 15 and then had immunizations. And it changed 15 months.
Yes.
He then had immunizations with immediate response requiring hospitalization and a severe change. The discussion of the condition or the things that you're discussing seem to be symptoms, not necessarily a cause. And so you have a diagnosis based on the way a child functions that gives it a title, but the actual change could be related to a physical response, such as in her case. And so,
such as to mercury,
and those kinds of things. What is your experience?
Well, I can tell you, I think I understand why it's confusing, because the answer is both. I mean, we do know that some children, after a severe brain injury, for whatever reason, including getting run over by a truck or falling out of a tall building, can display all the symptoms of autism. But, so that's what I mean by, it's, on one hand, it's very likely that that was the case. And I'll tell you another confusing aspect of it is that many cases of autism, it's a very typical story that the parents and the pediatricians and the grandparents and everybody thinks that this child is developing normally up until around that age, around, 15 to 18 months or so. And then they start not performing. So it's very confusing because either scenario may be true, and you don't know in retrospect which scenario was true, and in fact it could have been both. I don't know.
It
could have been both.
Spectrum disorder. We're really talking about a wide spectrum.
You're talking about unexpected, abrupt onset.
It's possible that many, many cases. I wouldn't say all of them, but many cases of what we call even capital A autism, I mean the severe autism, I'm not talking about the whole spectrum, but even the severe cases, many times parents and everyone that's a qualified observer has had the observation that these symptoms don't show up until 15 to 18 months or so. And the truth is that if you...
They talk and then they stop talking.
Right, and then they stop talking. You got it.
Yeah.
The truth is that as we know more and more about this, and this is one of the, remember when I said that pediatricians are trying to figure out how to make these early diagnoses, that's one of the very things that's being worked on right now, is earlier and earlier identification. And the closer we look, the more likely it's going to be true that we can pick these up earlier. It's just that we haven't had the tools to do it. So in the case of the Pettengill family, it may very well be that, number one, there was a genetic autism, the type that we've just been talking about, a genetic predisposition, and on top of that, a severe injury. In this case, it was a high fever, reportedly from the immunization, and immunizations can cause high fever, so there's no, I'm not saying it could be both. But it's clear why it's confusing, because just that very fact.
And there's huge debate over things like the extent to which mercury is involved. The reason mercury keeps coming up is because a chronic mercury poisoning has symptoms that look very much like autism.
Correct.
So,
correct.
It's sort of hard.
Well, I think the mercury issue has been settled, and the reason why it's been settled finally is because we now have enough cases of autism showing up in groups of kids that never got the measles vaccine. So,
well, it's a thimerosal thing that's probably settled, but not necessarily the mercury.
Thimerosal, yeah. Certainly. I mean, of course, if there's other mercury exposures, that could be another factor, right?
Anyway, if we could solve the etiology issue here, I'd be happy to take a vote and do that.
I don't have the answer.
Yeah, I think we're probably not going to do that. Do you have any more comments for us on the phone before we hang up on you?
Is she gone?
Betty lost.
Connie gone? We have hung up. Good. All right. We did hang up. I'm sorry.
She snoozed.
I would be willing to entertain any question. Anybody wants to contact me, I can find answers if I don't have them, and I appreciate that.
Well, and we're going to be back on this topic again. Representative Buckley,
Mr. Chair, thank you. The doctor has offered his services throughout any further discussion of this bill. I greatly appreciate that.
To all of you folks who've come to join us today, very difficult stories. We really appreciate you coming, and we'll take this very seriously. Okay. Don't gabble out. Right. I need to acknowledge receipt of a written testimony for the record from Pacific Source Health Plans. My assumption is that they're opposing the bill.
Correct.
Anything else?
And then, Mr. Chair.
You have some other written testimony. You haven't read it to the record?
And this is...
Could you give it to us so we can read it to the record?
He just passed it out to us. Do you want him to read it, or you just want to acknowledge it?
No, let's just acknowledge it for the record.
This is
from Bob Nickel.
All right,
Bob. Oh, a different Bob
Nickel.
Right,
it's not our Bob Nickel, right?
Oh, at OHSU?
Yeah, he's with CDRC.
CDRC.
And then...
and he supports the bill.
Yes, he does.
And the Northwest Autism Foundation,
right,
as a statement, I assume, also supporting the bill. And we'll read those into the record and make them available for the other members of the committee.
Yes.
Am I ready to gavel up?
Yes, you are. Good job.
30 minutes late. Okay. I will close the public hearing on 2918. Thank you all for helping us, and I will adjourn the meeting of the Subcommittee on Healthcare Access.